Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. This time, we're going to be talking about how some of these pop culture icons, how they manage to stay relevant over time.
That's a good question.
Like, how do you keep a myth alive, you know, breathing and evolving for new generations? We've got a lot of cool sources. We've been looking at articles, even dictionary definitions, all about these stories and characters that have really stood the test of time.
You know, it really makes you think, what's that secret sauce? You know, that cultural longevity?
Exactly. And yeah. I think our first example, this 70s anime phenomenon, Goldrake, I think that offers some clues.
Okay.
For those who don't know, Goldrake was this giant robot piloted by this prince from another planet.
Right.
And it was huge EE, especially in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, imagine a whole generation, like, singing that theme song.
Oh, I bet.
Dressing up as actress for Carnival.
Oh, wow.
So it really became deeply ingrained in that generation's collective memory. And that's where this idea of canon comes in.
Right.
For fan communities, canon refers to the official accepted storyline of a fictional universe.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, the original Goldrake series would be considered canon.
Exactly right.
Okay.
But then in 2021, a French comic book continued Goldrake's story like a full decade after the original series.
Wow.
And this comic is now considered official canon.
Wow. So it's like adding a new chapter to the official story.
Yeah.
That'd be exciting for some fans.
Definitely. But here's the thing, though. Not everyone was thrilled about it.
Really?
Some fans saw it as like a violation.
Oh.
Like someone was tampering with their childhood memories.
Oh, wow.
Which I think really highlights just how much emotional investment fans have in these stories.
Yeah. It makes you realize that for a lot of fans, these stories aren't just entertainment. They're part of their like personal history.
Absolutely. And it brings up a really interesting question. Like, does continuing a story, even if it's done officially, like, does it risk alienating the very fans who helped make it a phenomenon in the first place?
Yeah, it's like walking a tightrope, isn't it?
It is.
You know, how do you satisfy those who want the story to remain untouched while also appealing to new audiences who might not even know the original?
That's where I think the 2024 Saudi Arabian anime reboot Grandizer U comes in.
Okay.
Instead of continuing the story, they retell Goldrake's origin.
Yeah.
But like with a modern twist.
So it's like a fresh start, a chance to introduce the myth to a whole new generation.
Exactly.
Okay.
But even this approach, it faced its share of criticism as well.
Really?
Some fans felt that the animation style and the storytelling choices didn't really capture the essence of the original.
So it seems like there's no easy answer.
Right.
There's no guaranteed formula for success when it comes to keeping a myth alive.
It's what makes this whole exploration so intriguing.
Yeah.
It's this complex interplay of like creative choices, audience expectations, and just the evolution of cultural tastes.
This reminds me of something that that we came across in the research.
Okay.
That a dictionary definition of sequel is like a new series with the same characters following a successful work, almost like it's a necessity to keep a myth alive.
I think that's a really insightful point.
Yeah.
It suggests that there's this inherent expectation for these stories to continue to evolve. And that's where I think the concept of myth becomes really interesting.
Because it's not just a static story.
Right.
Right?
A myth is a living, breathing entity.
Yeah.
It needs to be nurtured, reinterpreted, passed on. Mm. You know, it's like an oral tradition changing subtly with each retelling.
Yeah, so maybe the key to keeping a myth alive isn't about preserving it in amber, but like allowing it to adapt and grow.
Mm. That's a fascinating thought.
Yeah.
And it leads us to our next example, which explores how different mediums kind of grapple with this very challenge.
Okay.
So let's move from animation to the stage with the Italian play Natale in Casa Cupiello.
Natale in Casa Cupiello. This is a holiday tradition in Italy, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's this heartwarming story about a family's chaotic Christmas. And it's become like so deeply ingrained in Italian culture, especially after that iconic 1977 televised version.
Yeah, that televised version is what many consider like the definitive one.
Right.
Almost like the fixed canon.
Exactly. People memorize the lines, the actors' nuances.
Right.
It became like the Natale in Casa Cupiello.
Mm-hmm.
But even the original play went through some significant changes in its early years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, two whole acts were added.
So even from the beginning, the play was evolving. It wasn't this static thing.
Yeah, that's right. But here's where I think things get really interesting. The nature of theater itself kind of plays a role in how the story is perceived.
Because it's a live performance, right? Not a recording.
Precisely. A filmed play, like that 1977 version, is frozen in time. But live theater is a living, breathing entity. It changes with each performance, with each actor's interpretation.
So every production of Natale and Casa Cupiello is essentially a reinterpretation, even if they're using the same script.
Exactly. And that brings us to the 2020 film adaptation directed by Eduardo De Angelis.
Okay.
This adaptation caused quite a stir because it stuck faithfully to the original script. But visually and tonally, it deviated from that classic 1977 version.
So even though the words were the same, the overall experience was different.
Right.
And people weren't happy about that.
Some weren't. They felt it wasn't faithful to the true Natale in Casa Cupiello, even though it was based on the original script.
Yeah.
You know, it shows how attached people can become to a particular interpretation.
It's like they're not just fans of the story, they're fans of a specific version of the story.
Exactly. And this tension between staying true to the original and reinterpreting it for a new audience is something we see play out time and again in pop culture.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, is there a point where a reinterpretation becomes like a betrayal of the original? Or are these changes necessary to keep a story relevant?
That's a question I think we'll continue to explore as we go deeper into this topic. But
yeah.
Before we move on, there's one more example of Natale in Casa Cupiello I think is worth examining.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What is it?
So in 2024, there was a live TV broadcast of the play starring Vincenzo Salome, a very popular Italian comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And his take leaned into the comedic aspects of the play.
Okay.
And it also received some criticism for straying from that sacred 1977 version.
So it seems like no matter what you do, someone's going to be unhappy.
Yeah.
If you change it too much, you alienate the purists. But if you stick too closely to the original, you risk being seen as unoriginal.
That's the dilemma, isn't it? But Salome himself had something interesting to say about this. He said that theater is the art of the absolute present.
That's a really thought-provoking statement, especially in the context of this discussion. It's like he's saying that each performance is its own unique entity, not a copy of something that came before.
And that clashes with the idea of a definitive, unchanging version of a play, doesn't it? Like, he's acknowledging that live theater resists that kind of rigid categorization.
This is also fascinating, but I feel like we've just scratched the surface.
We have.
Yeah.
And to really understand how myths stay relevant, we need to broaden our scope even further. So next, let's jump from the stage to the silver screen and explore how the world of superhero films grapples with this challenge of reinterpretation.
Speaking of reinterpretations, our next stop takes us to the world of superhero films.
Okay.
And perhaps the most iconic superhero of them all, Superman.
Right.
The upcoming 2025 film, directed by James Gunn, is rebooting the character yet again.
It's generating a lot of buzz.
A hit.
Both positive and negative.
Yeah.
Some fans are thrilled to see a fresh take on the character.
Right.
While others are apprehensive.
I can understand that.
Especially with the new actor, David Corenswet, stepping into the role.
Yeah, I mean, Superman has been played by so many actors over the years.
So many.
Each leaving their own mark on the character.
Right, and the comparisons to the previous Supermans.
Yeah.
Especially Henry Cavill from the Zack Snyder films are inevitable.
Of course.
But this brings up a really interesting point.
What's that?
Is there such a thing as a true Superman?
That's a great question. I mean, Superman has been around for over 80 years. He's been reimagined countless times in comics, films, TV shows.
Exactly. Each era, each creator brings their own interpretation to the character,
right,
reflecting the changing times and cultural landscape.
Like for many people, that 1978 Christopher Reeve film is Superman.
Right.
But even that was just one interpretation among many.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like each new film or comic run isn't meant to like replace what came before.
Right.
It's adding another layer to this rich tapestry of the Superman myth.
So in a way, it's like Superman is a constantly evolving entity shaped by the creators and the audiences who engage with him.
I think that's a brilliant way to put it. And that's what makes Superman so enduring. He's not this like static character frozen in time, but a reflection of our hopes and our fears and our aspirations.
Like Harlan Ellison said, Superman is an archetype of humanity's highest aspirations.
Exactly. He embodies our ideals.
Yeah.
And as our ideals evolve, so too must Superman.
So James Gunn's film will be his take on Superman.
Right. Adding to the ever-growing mythology of the character.
Yes, exactly.
Just as Richard Donner's and Zack Snyder's films were their unique interpretations.
It's the beauty of myths. They thrive on reinterpretation and adaptation. They are not bound by a single definitive version. And I think this is a concept that some fans, you know, those who cling to the idea of a pure, untouchable canon, I think they struggle with that.
Yeah, it's like they want to protect the myth from change, even if that change could breathe new life into it.
It's understandable. I mean, change can be unsettling, especially when it comes to something you hold dear.
Right.
But I think it's important to remember that myths are not these static artifacts. They're meant to be reinterpreted, reimagined, and passed on.
So maybe the question isn't whether or not to change a myth, but rather like how to do it in a way that honors the original while still making it relevant for a new generation.
That's a crucial point.
Yeah.
And it leads us to our next example, which takes us from the world of superheroes to the realm of music, specifically the enigmatic Neapolitan artist Liberato. Oh, I have to admit, I'm fascinated by this artist.
Oh, yeah.
Their identity is a secret. And their music is this incredible blend of like classic Neapolitan sounds with modern genres like trap.
It's a very unique sound that's captivated audiences worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
But his third album, released on January 1st, 2025, it sparked a debate that goes to the heart of our conversation today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Some critics argued that his heavy use of sampling, especially of Teresa DeCio's 1982 song Volia Eterna, was, they called it parasitic.
Parasitic. That seems like a harsh term.
It does.
I mean, sampling has been a part of music for decades.
You're absolutely right. Sampling has a long history dating back to the late 1960s. Think of Stevie Wonder, who was a master at incorporating sampling into his music.
So it's not the act of sampling itself that's the issue, but how it's done.
Exactly. The criticism leveled at Liberato wasn't about sampling in general, but about whether his use of it was transformative or simply derivative.
So in the case of Liberato, is he just copying or is he creating something new out of those borrowed elements?
That is the key question. And I think it's important to note that Liberato's music doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Right.
He's drawing on a rich musical tradition.
Yeah.
Blending classic Neapolitan sounds with these modern genres like trap.
He's not just borrowing the sounds. He's like weaving them into something new and exciting, much like Pino Daniele did before him.
Absolutely. That's a great parallel. Pino Daniele also reinterpreted Neapolitan music, blending it with jazz, blues, rock. And it's worth noting that Liberato even samples Daniele's work in his music.
So there's a clear lineage, a connection between past and present. It's not just about copying. It's about building on what came before.
Exactly. Liberato's music is a conversation with the past, a reinterpretation of Neapolitan musical traditions for a new generation.
And it's not just the music itself. Liberato has created like this whole cinematic universe.
Yes.
Through his music videos and a documentary, further blurring the lines between fiction and reality.
He's taken the mystery surrounding his identity and turned it into an integral part of his art. And that, I believe, is another key aspect of keeping a myth alive, creating a world that people want to immerse themselves in, a world that sparks their imagination and keeps them wanting more.
It's like he's taken the Neapolitan myth and given it a 21st century makeover.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And this brings us back to the central question of our deep dive. Who gets to decide what a myth should be? Who are the guardians of these stories, these characters, these cultural touchstones?
It's a complex question with no easy answers. But I think we've seen some common threads emerge from our discussion so far.
Oh, absolutely. We've seen how fiercely protective fans can be of the myths they love.
Right.
Often resisting any changes or reinterpretations.
We saw it with Goldrick. We saw it with Natale and Casacupiello.
Right.
And I'm sure we'll see it with James Gunn's Superman.
It's a natural reaction. I mean, people feel a sense of ownership over these stories.
Yeah.
And when they see them being changed, it can feel like a personal attack.
But as we've also seen, change is inevitable. Myths are not static. They evolve, they adapt, they are reinterpreted.
And that's what keeps them alive.
Right.
The myths that endure are the ones that are flexible enough to be reimagined to resonate with different audiences across time.
So maybe the real question isn't whether or not myths should change, but rather how those changes are made.
That's a great point. Yeah. And I think our final example, which delves into the world of comics, offers some valuable insights into this very question.
So we've talked about anime and theater and film and music. Now let's dive into the world of comics and see how they grapple with this idea of reinterpreting and revitalizing a myth.
Yeah, comics, they provide a really interesting case study because they have such a long and complex history of reinterpretations and reboots.
Yeah.
Characters like Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, I mean, they've been around for decades,
constantly
being reimagined by different writers and artists.
And with each new interpretation, you get a slightly different take on the character.
Right, a new perspective on their motivations, their struggles, their relationships. And sometimes those reinterpretations can be quite drastic.
Yeah.
Take Batman, for example.
Okay.
In 1988, when Michael Keaton was cast as Batman, there was a huge outcry from fans.
Oh, really?
They couldn't imagine the comedic actor known for Beetlejuice as the brooding Dark Knight.
But of course, we know how that turned out. Right. Keaton's performance became iconic.
And the film is considered a classic.
Exactly.
It's a great example of how initial skepticism can sometimes be unfounded.
Right.
It also highlights how a bold reinterpretation can breathe new life into a character, even one as well established as Batman.
This makes me think about the Italian comic Viva Valentina.
Okay.
It featured new stories about the character Valentina created by the legendary Hugo Pratt.
Right.
For those unfamiliar, Valentina was this photojournalist, a strong, independent woman who often found herself embroiled in these kind of fantastical adventures.
Right.
And Viva Valentina was interesting because it brought in new writers and artists to explore the character, expanding her world, adding new layers to her personality. Initially, there was resistance from some fans who saw it as a departure from Pratt's original vision.
Right.
But it opened the door for other reinterpretations, didn't it?
It did.
It showed that even beloved characters created by iconic artists could be explored by new voices without losing their essence.
Exactly. And it paved the way for other projects, like the continuation of the Corto Maltese series after Hugo Pratt's death. Corto Maltese was this seafaring adventurer, another iconic creation of Pratt's.
Right.
And the decision to continue his stories was met with trepidation from some fans.
They probably felt it was disrespectful to continue the series without the original creator. I can understand that sentiment.
Yeah, it's a valid concern. But the continuation of Corto Maltese actually proved to be quite successful. The new creators approached the character with respect and a deep understanding of Pratt's work.
It's almost like they were entrusted with this precious artifact, tasked with preserving its beauty while also finding ways to make it shine even brighter.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And I think it gets to the heart of what we've been discussing. It's this delicate balance between honoring the past and embracing the possibilities of the present.
So where does that leave us? We've explored these examples from various mediums, and we've seen how creators and audiences grapple with this idea of reinterpreting and revitalizing myths. What are your final thoughts on this?
I think the key takeaway here is that myths are not static. They're living, breathing entities that need to evolve in order to survive. And while it's natural for fans to feel protective of the stories they love, it's important to remember that change is not always a bad thing. In fact, it can be essential for a myth to remain relevant and resonate with new generations.
So maybe the best way to honor a myth isn't to keep it locked away in a museum, but to allow it to be reinterpreted, reimagined, and rediscovered by each new generation.
I think that's a wonderful way to put it. Myths are not meant to be static artifacts, but rather vibrant stories that continue to evolve and speak to us in new and meaningful ways.
Well said. It's been a fascinating deep dive. Thank you for sharing your insights with us today.
It's been my pleasure. And to our listeners, I encourage you to think about your own relationship with your favorite myths. How do you feel about reinterpretations and reboots? Embrace the conversation, the evolution, and the enduring power of stories to connect us across time and cultures.